Welcome to Leading Lines, a podcast on educational technology from Vanderbilt University. I'm your host, Derek Bruff, director of the Vanderbilt Center for Teaching. We're back. The Leading Lines summer break is over, and I'm happy to kick off our fall season with a fun and inspirational interview with Brian Dewsbury, assistant professor of biological sciences at the University of Rhode Island. I met Brian through Isis Artsevega, who directs the Teaching Center at Florida International University, where Brian earned his PhD. She spoke highly of his interest in inclusive teaching and his integration of technology in and out of the classroom. It wasn't until after I interviewed him that I learned he's working on a scholarly writing project with my Center for Teaching colleague, Cynthia Brame. She has great things to say about him, too, and I think you'll understand why after you listen to our interview. He's incredibly passionate about student success, and he uses technology in ways that are fully supportive of his pedagogical goals. His approach to teaching introductory biology isn't the typical one, and I'm glad to have him share his story here on the podcast. Well, Brian, thanks for talking with me today. I'm glad to get to know you and your teaching a little bit more. Can you give me a little context for your teaching? What are the courses that you teach? Who are the students? What does that look like?
So I teach four courses. I teach in the fall, I teach an introductory biology class. That's a relatively high enrollment, 140 students. And then I also teach an honors section to that, which is smaller, 40 students. In the spring, I teach a grad class on course design in STEM. And then I also teach a seminar class for upper division undergraduates on problem solving of social problems.
Okay. And so a range of students, actually, right?
Quite a big range, yes.
beginning bio majors all the way up to grad students.
Right.
Let's talk about your intro course, right? Mm-hmm. Your big course. Uh-huh. What are the goals that you have for that course, both for yourself as a teacher and for your students?
Oh, wow. How long is this podcast again? Well, you know, it's a good question because, you know, in our field, as you know, we are big on terms like learning outcomes and goals, and they have to be written this very particular way. But I do get a sense that your question is a bit more general, right? Like, what do I hope the students, broadly defined, walk out the door being, you know, in 3 months after spending 3 months in that classroom? And I use that language intentionally because very much when I think about designing a course, any course, I am not so much thinking about what I want them to know or not even so much what I want them to do. I'm actually thinking about who I want them to be as people. So everything we do in the course, whether it's technology or not technology, you know, ties back to the kind of individual I think collectively we can really help be a part of a functional democracy. That includes myself. That means that when I interact with students, when I meet a new crop of freshmen or grad students or whatever the case may be, I grow in the process. I learn from their stories. I learn about the human experience and the diversity of it. I learn about different ways in which they engage in material. And so in that paradigm, biology as a subject matter really is secondary. It's important, but it's secondary. They will go on and be wonderful professionals of different types. And in this ever-changing, globalized world, engaging with content is a skill that they will have to retain for the rest of their lives, and that content may or may not be biology. That's sort of one small thing, a part of really interesting thing. So I know it's a bit of a kind of a paragraphy answer, but that is essentially kind of how I think about what my goals are, for them to be good, honest citizens who can help advance the common good.
Mm. So that's ambitious.
But in 3 months, you could do it.
right. Well, tell me some of the ways that plays out in your interactions with students in your classroom.
Well, the interaction has to start before they get to the classroom. The interaction begins with a lot of self-reflection and me, you know, owning up to things I could do better, biases that I may have, understandings about the social context of learning that I need to brush up on. The changing ways in which education is delivered and implemented. I have to learn a lot about the new crop of students coming in, so that means working with institutional research and getting some kind of background data. I send them my own surveys through our learning management system to get some, you know, additional kind of broader interest information and some kind of backdrop information. And then once we're face to face, then we can engage in other things that could help enhance that relationship, right? So I have them write reflective essays about themselves as private, meaning between myself and them. I use a lot of small group work to give them opportunities to get to know each other and constructively engage in problem solving activities. I have a particular, I want to say theatrical style, not to sound over the top, but ways in which you could create a classroom climate that's comfortable and warm and trusting. So all these things, you know, no one particular thing is the way in which you build communities. All these things collectively, I think, come together to help create the relationship that I'm looking for.
Well, as you know, this is a technology podcast, mm-hmm. and so let me go ahead and ask, mm-hmm. given that goal of mm-hmm. helping your students become, you know, productive, empathic citizens, mm-hmm. and your own goals in kind of building relationships with them, where does technology come in? What are some of the technologies you use in this course, and how do you think they lead to the kind of success that you're looking for?
So in a variety of ways, and you know, I pause because I really want to make this distinction clear. I mean, as a technophile, I think that's a word, right?
Yeah.
I do appreciate the power and the value that technology can play in enhancing the educational experience. But the technology in and of itself is a separate thing to pedagogy and teaching and the quality of teaching. So in other words, to the degree to which the technology can help enhance the outcomes determines the amount of technology I use. So say some classes where if I can create that sense of community, if I can connect to them without having to invest in courseware, then I do that. So every time the decision is made to have them purchase something or involve a piece of technology in a class, it has to be with the clear goal of enhancing a particular outcome, right? So in the case of IntroBio, which was your original question, we do have a learning management system, but my textbook of choice right now, underlined, does have a pretty robust courseware system that ties to a test bank that I like. And, you know, I've worked with them over the years to kind of build up that courseware platform to include a lot of dialoguing type things like forums and fora and other things that allow for me to contact them before I see them, to link them a little bit more clearly to the link the learning outcomes of the class, at least the content-based ones, to the text, to the content in the text, to provide opportunities to give me feedback on how they are responding to different kinds of assessments, to allow me to intervene at critical points before any student gets, say, too lost in a particular topic, to create a sense of anonymity in cases where that's helpful, right? So to give an example, in the 150-student class, I may ask a question. I use what we call immediate feedback assessment, right? So, you know, I'll explain something for 10 minutes, 8 minutes, and then I'll throw a question out to the class. That's a multiple choice question, and, you know, okay, explain such and such, A, B, C, D. 20% may choose B, 10% choose C, another 50% choose D, but the answer is really A. And so then I say, okay, well, clearly maybe something I said didn't quite click. Let's try that again. On that same screen, there's actually a little envelope that allows a student who may not be comfortable saying to his or her group or maybe out loud that they are completely lost, they can send me a message directly, right, which I could periodically kind of check my screen, and I will either come up to them during class or maybe after class to maintain privacy and things like that. So all these are little things, and like I said before, no one thing is the panacea. It's all of them together that help kind of enhance that idea of trust and collusion.
Yeah, and so just to clarify that last example, so the system you're using is the courseware that comes with your textbook?
Correct.
for that in-class polling kind of feature.
Yes, yes. I mean, there's 100 options out there, but sure. This is the one
I
choose.
I wrote a book in 2009 on teaching with classroom response systems. Mm-hmm. So, yes, there have only been more systems that have become available since then. So,
right.
So this one's through your textbook, which is great. And so the students have a mobile device out in the classroom to respond to these questions,
correct.
Right? And so
correct.
That's what allows them to send that email. Mm-hmm. And in this case, when you say anonymity, in that case, it's the ability to connect with you around a question or a problem without having to admit that to their peers,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's the kind of that level of anonymity.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And as you said, there are times when that's the kind of the helpful form of anonymity.
Right. Right. Right.
Yeah.
Go on.
Yeah, I was going to ask, can you say more about the intervening that you sometimes do with students, kind of to try to spot students who might be headed for some trouble in the course?
Right.
How does that play out?
Yeah, and just to give some context on that. So intro bio, I find intro bio, I hate to sound all poetic, but to me, intro bio is a really, really special class. It really, really is. I mean, it's for the students that I teach, which is a very traditional public research university, my students are usually 17 to 19 years old. This is a major transition point in their lives. And even for ones who come into my classroom well-prepared in terms of conventional metrics like SAT scores and ACT scores and GPAs, I still have to undo a lot of bad habits that they learned in high school on how science works and how metacognition works, how knowing that you know things really work. So there's a sense in which... I would argue that 60% of my intro bio class in terms of what we do is really social. It's really engaging a student and teaching them what it means to be confident in knowing something, what it means to clearly articulate a scientific thought, what it means to engage in constructive problem solving and having difference of opinion and doing that respectfully, what it means to develop a science identity, whatever that may mean. How do you bring in and leverage your own cultural histories and your own sense of being and view of the world into this new vernacular, you know, called science and you know, specifically intro bio. Those are social things. You know, the content happens sort of in between that or within that, but it's really you know, being with them and facilitating that development process, right? So in intro bio, we rarely generate new knowledge. We are more, and I don't want to make this sound like indoctrination, but you're working with students to develop an identity process, right? So with that context, when there are struggles, many times, and my data suggests this, the struggles have little to do with actual ability to do the work. The struggles have to do with inability to manage time, lack of awareness on what it means to know something, failure, fixed mindsets, you know, sense of belonging, low sense of belonging, things like this. So in response to that, it is my responsibility to structure my class to be able to detect those things early enough so that initial assessments aren't predictive of eventual failures in the class, right? I need to find a way to get that information so that I can design an intervention, right, that helps them feel like they belong, that, you know, talks about what time management means, that talks about what comprehension means. And that has to happen early enough so that that student gets an opportunity to demonstrate the potential that they really have inside, right? So it's intensive, it's aggressive, it's time consuming, at least at the point in time when it happens, but the payoff is so large that it's worth every second of it, right? So
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You take some time and you look at your spreadsheet or you look at your gradebook, and if it's well designed, you're looking at not just who's not doing well, but what are they not doing well in? Are they doing well on recall, but then struggling on synthesis and apply? Are they not coming to class? are they doing well on individual assignments, but not well on group assignments? Is there some mechanism for accountability within the group? I mean, there are there are so many things to really unpack when you look at a well-designed assessment structure. It can provide a lot of information about your individual students, but you have to set up the assessment structure for it to be able to provide that information. So, and if it can in fact provide that information, then you have a lot with you when you do that intervention. Does that make sense? Right?
Yeah. And so you're so one of the things that I've struck, because part of our work here at the Center for Teaching is we manage Brightspace, which is our course management system here on campus. And you know, the platform has some really great dashboard style analytics you can get on your students, and you can use it for kind of early warning intervention kind of thing. But one of the things that we struggle with sometimes here at Vanderbilt is that so much of our students' work is actually not in the system, right? You actually have to have the students' data in the system in some way. Either they're doing quizzes in the system, or you're recording grades in the system.
Right.
So it sounds like you're having your students do enough stuff in your courseware that the courseware itself is generating the kind of analytics that helps you figure out, oh, actually, if I look carefully, the student right here is having some struggles here and there.
Yes and no. So yes, in the sense that the courseware I use right now, which is Modified Mastering Biology by Pearson, is currently working on an early alert system based on the things that are within the questions that are within the system. The algorithm is being refined. They've had a couple trial runs. I've pointed out some things I think can give false positives in terms of who needs help, etc. So I'm confident they'll get there. Right now, I don't think they are. Right. So when I say analytics, in my case, I mean Excel the many things I use.
Let's be real here. Yeah.
And I used to assign. I used to assess. And knowing, you know, what I put into each question and looking at each thing carefully. So, yeah, it is more time consuming. And I definitely am looking forward to whoever has much more skills than I to sort of really take this whole early alert issue bull by the horns and really kind of solve it. Because people like me do dream of a day where I could come into my office and have my two, like, big monitors and pull up Derek. Derek wasn't in class 2 days last week. He did really well on quizzes. He does good on all the application questions, but messes up on recall. You know, yes, it sounds a little creepy, big brotherish, but if it's done responsibly, it could, you know, with a clear moral goal in mind, I think it could be really powerful.
So you're saying right now you have to do a lot of the looking yourself.
Correct.
And looking through the data and finding that, which makes sense. And honestly, that's, I think that's kind of where we are with the state of the software. There's another piece of that though. You're tracking certain student activities, and I guess that's what I'd like to hear a little bit more. Kind of how do you get at the more nuanced student learning behaviors? I mean, you can have them take a quiz and you get, you know, some auto graded stuff, but are there things you do to track? Is it knowing the difference between an individual assignment and a group work assignment? How do you tease out some of those metacognitive struggles that students have?
That's a good question. I think you're actually tapping on maybe a bigger issue the field of ed tech is going to have. Maybe it's not a problem. Maybe it's the kind of thing where, as I've argued in the past, that as tech gets better, we who are physically in the classroom will have to think a bit more carefully on why we are asking students to physically show up. And, you know, there are parts of my early intervention system that are completely human, that is not captured by any spreadsheet, is not captured by any assessment. It's me physically looking at the body language of a student and looking at the eyes sunken in and the shoulders that are drooped and the people who are staring at me, but they're not really staring at me, or people who are nodding me along in class, but I know they actually don't understand it. And, you know, so there are little things that, you know, I know this is a tech podcast, but honestly, there are things that I learned from a theater professor on how to read body language and how to read human beings and how to be, you know, so in the moment that you are picking up on all these little micro behaviors that is not present on any spreadsheet I have. And so when I kind of pick up on those things, those are the students I bring into my office, who I call their cell phone, who I try to make sure they come to office hours, because I want to know the story behind that those tired eyes, right? I want to know the story behind you on time for every day of class, today you were 10 minutes late. What's up? You know, so you have to be willing to pick up, you know, that sort of last mile. And it's almost like having a mixed methods approach to your teaching. And that component, I think, Derek, is extremely, extremely important. That's the nuance.
I'm curious, though. I'm struck. You're fairly young as a faculty member, mm-hmm. right, yourself?
Thank you.
But you have, you know, already demonstrated to me in this interview a fair degree of sophistication in your teaching practices, in your knowledge of the literature around student learning. I'm wondering what was part of your journey to get here? Were there elements of your graduate education or other experiences that informed your current practices around teaching? Because I think they're a little exceptional for a junior faculty member.
Yeah, you know, there are a few things, and to me, the way this works, and I have to get a little philosophical here, in that, you know, when you're 38, which I am, I know it's a podcast, they can't see me, so I'll just tell you all, I'm 38. When you're 38, you know, what
I'm 41, so we'll call that young.
We'll call it even.
We'll go younger now.
When, you know, what you're doing in your life right now, your sense of identity, it's informed by so many things that it's hard to kind of reduce that impact to one particular time period, right? So there were things that happened in grad school, there were things that happened before grad school. I think there were things that happened before grad school that I only realized once I was actually teaching how much they impacted what I do. You know, I'll try to sort of summarize a combination of those things, right? So I was a marine ecology grad student. You know, I think I was, you know, pretty traditional in terms of you kind of go in and you do research, and the idea is that you go on to a research position in STEM and have your own research program. And I was actually actively avoiding the classroom on the advice of people that it would take away from research. But the RA funding, we weren't able to work it out, so I had to teach. I was awful. I was pretty bad. I had no training. I'm not making excuses, but I had no training. Yeah. But, you know, I kind of reflected on how bad the thing was. I mean, it wasn't really a disaster, to be honest. I mean, I was very conventional, but I know it could have been better. And I remember the second class that I taught, you know, which if you come to my office, I have a picture of them on my wall. You know, I really took time to get to know them. I actually interviewed each one of them one by one in my office. And I talked to them about their life, why they want to be a doctor, why they chose bio as a major. And you just learn. I learned so much about who they were trying to be, who they thought they were, and the role that the classes they were taking played into that equation, some of the misconceptions they had about how science worked. And, you know, because we were able to develop that relationship, that semester, the teaching experience was just radically different because I learned things about them, and then I designed a curriculum around who they were. I didn't just walk into class and kind of hand them something that was given to me by a head TA, you know, to just, you know, make sure you don't blow the lab up and just do this. And I think that experience, probably above any other experience I'll talk about, was the most informative thing about what the power of transformative teaching could be. It wasn't about, you know, yes, you want them to do bio well, you want them to explain concepts, yada, yada, yada. But you really wanted them to be happy with who they were, you know, actively engaged in those choices and seeing how, you know, being, you know, ascribing to that identity could be impactful to a future just society. And, you know, I think most importantly, I found that there was a way to take those lofty ideals and operationalize that into actual things you do every day in the classroom, right? Yeah. So I could, you know, extend that to say that, yes, I'm the son of a retired pastor, and I think, you know, growing up, you know, I'm not, I don't practice anymore, but growing up in that environment and the way in which he engaged his congregants, I think I've absorbed some of that style and, you know, that whole idea of, you know, so, you know, the word pastor comes from pastoral farming, meaning that as a shepherd, you take responsibility for the livelihoods of your sheep. None of my students are sheep, but you do view the community as we're all taking responsibility for each other's growth. So if they don't do well, I take that on. Like, there was something I could have done differently, right, to make them more excited about it or something I didn't connect to. You know, at the time when I was going through this process, you know, interest in teaching and scholarship of teaching and learning was still, I would say, in its infancy. Very well-meaning people advised me to stop and go back to being a real grad student. But I'm very grateful for the support of our Center for Teaching and Learning we had at FIU at the time, and the people there who are still good friends of mine, good friends and colleagues of mine. And I think without their support, I don't know if I would have been able to navigate, well, A, develop the skill set, B, have the support, the emotional and professional support to think about teaching in a scholarly way and develop the kind of portfolio that allows me to do what I do now. And in that relationship, I think, you know, so you develop the passion, but then, you know, you actually learn the skills of what it means to do this in a classroom. And so there were other things along the way. I was a part of the Biology Scholars Program, which was run by the American Society for Microbiology for a few years. Still do a lot of work with them, including one of the editors on their journal. And yeah, I mean, the broader, the at the time, it was a very new community doing what we call discipline-based education research. And I've been a part of that group from the start, and it's been a pleasure to see how much I think we've grown as a group to hopefully do better and better work. So,
yeah. Are there other technologies you use in your teaching that we haven't talked about?
Yes, I mean, so I guess your question before, you know, focused on courseware, and I talked a lot about modified mastering that Pearson uses, but I would say another, you know, I don't know if it's another technology per se, because it's still kind of running content or running a syllabus through a platform. But we have put a lot of time and effort and some resources in the last couple of years into looking at open education resources, with the goal in mind to reduce the cost of the experience to students without reducing the quality of the experience. I would say it's been hit and miss. So this fall we'll be using OpenStax Biology for the honors class with Top Hat. And we put a lot of time into course design this spring to see how that would look like. So we're going to run that this fall and see what it looks like.
So that's the textbook itself is from OpenStax.
Correct.
And then the platform is Top Hat,
correct,
which does in-class and out-of-class student engagement.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. That course is also taught in an active learning classroom, which I bet you're familiar with.
Yeah.
So it, you know, it's in 9 tables of 5 each and outfitted with TVs and the mics. And, you know, I maximize it. There are times I do feel like, do you really need all of this stuff? but if you kind of really think creatively and kind of turn that 40-student class into almost like a think tank, we really have a lot of fun with case studies and ways in which they could kind of share the ways in which they do problems with the whole class and stuff like that. So that's been a major investment, and I think we've had a lot of fun. In all honesty, I would say I've yet to hit the ceiling of how much I could probably do in that space, but I've only used it twice. So I kind of expect, as I kind of think about the class more creatively, I expect that to increase. I have to say, technology aside, the thing I like the most about the classroom is that it's flat. Like that does so much. Forces you, and you know, I'm a mover by nature anyway, but just not having to go upstairs and have them all look at you in this kind of very traditional hierarchical way, it sets the tone from day one, right? You know, we all in this space just doing this together. And yeah, that's the free part of it, the cheap part of it.
Right. Well, let me ask a couple more questions. So you mentioned that you do a course for grad students on STEM course design.
Yes.
And that connects to a question I had planned to ask you, which is what advice would you offer maybe a brand new faculty member in the STEM fields as they think about growing their teaching practices over time? They're interested in inclusive teaching. They're interested in student success. What advice do you give someone who's just getting started in their teaching career?
This is a tough one because, and this is not you, Derek. I think a lot of times when people ask that question, the knee-jerk response is to give a kind of a practical strategy, you know, say, you know, look into clickers or look into this. And as you probably could tell based on my answers to the other questions, I really do view this practice as a responsibility. And I think for too long in STEM in particular, we've taken a very mechanistic approach to it, in that because we have PhDs and we are experts in our discipline, we are therefore qualified to impart that expertise on 17-year-olds who may or may not think that what a scientist looks like is what we look like. And what the research, especially the social science research, has shown us is there's a lot more that goes into that. There's a lot more that goes into identity development and, you know, what it means to educate for liberation and things like that. And so I put that context because I honestly, Derek, I don't want anybody to walk into this profession, and I mean the classroom, without really committing themselves to understanding the full history of why that classroom looks the way it does, right? I mean, and it takes a while. You know, my wife is a K-12 teacher, and they apprentice for a long time before they are given their own classroom, right? Yeah. Why is it we take freshly minted grad students or postdocs and then throw them in a 200-person lecture on Monday morning and think we're going to get anything else but a disaster, right? And I argue that we have to really start thinking about all the things that we need to know to understand what inclusion means, right? We have to understand the history of STEM education in this country. We have to understand the history of the practice of science itself. You have to understand the history of why equity gaps exist in terms of achievement and all these kinds of things. And you have to understand yourself. You have to understand why you do it and what kind of responsibility you have to shape hearts and minds. And then really when you have that full understanding, that is the space within which you should be thinking about curriculum design. You will find that to enhance your outcomes, you may need technology or you may not. The point is not the technology. The point is the student, right? And you know, sorry for the long answer, but it's been a question I get a lot, right? And you know, I could kind of spend a whole other podcast recommending things I would love for people to start reading and think about. But it has to start with really a commitment to what does it mean to teach? What does it mean to teach for inclusion? And what are the kinds of things I need to understand in order to do that well? And so I could send you a list which you could put in your website maybe, but.
Yeah, I've got one more question. We ask this at the end of all of our interviews. We focus a lot on the podcast on digital educational technology. So I'd like to ask, what's one of your favorite analog educational technologies?
Analog. Okay. All right. So when I do, when we talk about osmosis, I like to introduce that topic by talking about the laws of thermodynamics and how energy works. It's tough because it's an intro bio class and you're trying to provide like a basic physics context for it, right? So what I usually do is, you know, talk about chemical potential energy, kinetic energy, and I call a student from the class to come to front, and I bring a volleyball with me in class, and we bump and we play a game to see who can keep the ball up as much as we can. And while we're doing that, I have the class think about how the energy changes, what different kind of energy they see changing, you know, from chemical to kinetic, heat is lost, et cetera, et cetera. So one of the reasons I kind of like that is because that's actually one of the early classes when they're still sort of nervous and they're still kind of they're kind of feeling me out, you know, see what kind of professor I'll be. And that ends up being a way to sort of break the ice and get them more comfortable. You know, I used to play beach volleyball like twice a week in Miami. So you know, I guess I have a mini athletic side. So it's, analog, simple, but we have a good, fun discussion about it.
That's great.
Yeah, and they get to make fun of me. So.
That's great. I love that story. Well, thank you, Brian. This has been really great.
Yeah, man. My pleasure.
That was Brian Dewsbury, assistant professor of biological sciences at the University of Rhode Island. I just love how technology is a tool for Brian. It's never the focus of his efforts. It's just that he uses whatever tools he can to help his students become more confident, capable citizens and scientists. It's also great to see someone fairly new to faculty life, he just finished his PhD 4 years ago, incorporate into his courses so many evidence-based teaching practices. We have decades of research arguing for active learning instruction, for the value of formative assessment, for the importance of metacognition and learning. Brian has very quickly adopted an approach to teaching that leverages all this research, and he does it with such passion for students and for their success. In my work at Vanderbilt and elsewhere, I'm often trying to help more experienced faculty take very small steps towards more evidence-based teaching practices. It's really great to see someone who's all in, and it speaks to the value of preparing future faculty members while they're still in grad school. If you want to find out more about Brian and his work, see the show notes for lots of resources, including a great talk Brian gave at a STEM conference last year and his very recent interview on Teaching in Higher Ed, Bonnie Stachowiak's most excellent podcast. You can find those show notes on our website, leadinglinespod.com, where you'll also find past Leading Lines episodes. We have 40 of them now, with full transcripts. And over on Twitter, you can find us at Leading Lines Pod. I'm at Derek Bruff, and Brian is at BM Dewsbury. We would all love to hear how you leverage technology for inclusive teaching and student success. Leading Lines is produced by the Vanderbilt Center for Teaching, the Vanderbilt Institute for Digital Learning, the Office of Scholarly Communications at the Vanderbilt Libraries, and the Associate Provost for Education, Development, and Technologies. This episode was edited by Rhett McDaniel. Look for new episodes the first and third Monday of each month. I'm your host, Derek Bruff. Thanks for listening.